Another COP, another failure to save the planet. The 27th edition of the UN Conferences of Parties ended with no agreement to curb emissions, but a deal was agreed on a climate damage and loss fund. Is that enough? And do these conferences serve any purpose? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Mohammed Jamjoum. For the first time, members of the United Nations Climate Conference have agreed to compensate poorer nations hit hardest by climate change. Delegates from low-income countries say they're optimistic. That's despite no agreements being reached on where the money will come from, nor how it will be distributed. There were also no new commitments on curbing greenhouse gas emissions. And while there's optimism, some nations left Egypt saying not enough progress was made. We'll begin our discussion in a moment, but first, let's listen to what some leaders had to say.
We recognize that there have been indications of a disappointment in certain quarters who had a higher degree of ambition, but that disappointment, I think, should be put in context. I think the level of ambition of all of the parties is equal. So it is, I think, important during the year of our presidency until we hand over to the Emirates. I will be an advocate for the preservation of the 1.5, for the increase of all ambition within the capabilities that are available.
COP27 concludes with much homework and little time. We are already halfway between the Paris Climate Agreement and the 2030 deadline. We need all hands on deck to drive justice and ambition. And this also includes ambition to end the suicidal war on nature that is fueling the climate crisis.
The European Union came here to get strong language agreed, and we are disappointed we didn't achieve this. I strongly urge us all to roll up our sleeves and show to the world that the fight for ambition for a better future is not yet over.
This year is the first year after the implementation details of the Paris Agreement were agreed and also marks the 30th anniversary of the signing of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Therefore, Egypt has set the theme of this conference as delivering to stress implementation and that all parties need to deliver on their promises. Egypt is also a developing nation. This year's COP conference is held in a developing country, reached an achievement in the establishment of the Loss and Damage Fund. It could be seen as a highlight. The conference also decided to establish a global adaptation framework. These are all strongly urged by developing countries.
All right, let's go ahead and bring in our guests. From Brussels, Chiara Martinelli, Climate Action Network Europe Director. From Nairobi, Abdi Ainte, a former minister of planning in Somalia and a former senior UN official. And from Kiel in the UK, Sharon George, senior lecturer in environmental sustainability and green technology at Kiel University. A warm welcome to you all, and thanks so much for joining us today on Inside Story. Abdi, let me start with you today. Just how significant is it that this loss and damage fund was set up during COP27? And do you think that it actually will help developing nations cope with climate change going forward?
There is no question that the setup of this fund is a tremendous progress when you look at the totality of the efforts that have been made over the last many years in relation to the climate crisis. But we need to remember that this is only a fund. There is no money in it just for now, and probably not for another year or so while the committee works on the detail. That's number one. But more importantly, I think the fund, when and if it goes on and operational, it is supposed to help developing countries to mitigate the climate crisis, flooding, droughts, a famine in this part of the world, in the Horn of Africa. It's supposed to do that in theory, but a lot of the details are not there yet. So we'll have to wait until the committee actually finishes its work in about a year time.
Abdi, let me just follow up, because the fact of the matter is, as you said, there is no money in this fund yet. Essentially, this is a bucket that was set up, and the bucket is still empty. And there have been other times in the last 10 years or so when funds were set up. I believe there was an adaptation fund where poorer nations, developing countries, were supposed to get $100 billion a year, and I don't believe they're getting anywhere near that, if anything at all. I mean, is there any sense of when these funds might start being available to the countries?
Well, it's very difficult to imagine that this fund will receive the amount of money that it was supposed to be receiving, considering the fact that a lot of these countries, the big emitters, for example, the United States and other big countries, are democracies, and their power of the purse rests with Congress, for example, in the U.S. We know the Biden administration will face a divided Congress for the next 2 years. So with the Republicans in charge of the lower house of the Congress, you know, I can't foresee them approving money for United Nations fund, and they've already criticized it. Same can be said about other Western democracies. So I think, you know, it's always expected out of these international conferences to lay out very lofty goals and ultimately fall significantly shorter on them. And I think, unfortunately, this sounds like, you know, the same, although I don't want to preclude the possibility of actually it being worked out quite meticulously.
Sharon, I saw you reacting to some of what Abdi was saying there, so I'm going to let you jump in. But I also want to ask you, from your perspective, was enough accomplished at COP27?
Nowhere near enough, not in terms of what we're seeing with climate change now. You know, you can liken this to, you know, a flooding, tap flooding, and all this is doing is kind of mopping up the damage that's been caused. It's not really putting enough investment into what's going to happen. And what we're seeing is this kind of evolving situation, climate change becoming worse, and it will become worse with the emissions that are already there. And not enough emphasis has been there in terms of planning for the future. We're just kind of mitigating against what has happened and just kind of investing in keeping the infrastructure there to keep carrying on doing what we're doing. And it's almost like a business as usual case. And I think a lot more urgency needs to be done right now, especially to affect those countries that are, you know, they're going to lose all you know, ability to live where they live. You know, there's a real urgency for more funding right now for people that are affected right now.
Kiara, if I could get your thoughts on COP27, from your perspective, what were some of its successes and what were some of its failures?
Yes, I think the major success, and I think we do need to celebrate, is the agreement of all countries to finally answer to poor countries' requests to create a fund on loss and damage. And I think this is important to recognize, even if, as we have been saying, like there is a lot of work to be done in terms of to make it operational. But I think it's really important politically that all countries agreed in Africa to deliver on loss and damage finance. And I think this needs to be highlighted. Of course, we are worried about the follow-up work, and we will keep our pressure to make sure that this fund gets all the procedural details that are needed to make that is operational as of the COP next year. I think it's also important to say that, of course, we do, as a civil society from all over the world, we do recognize this also as an important success of all the mobilization that civil society have been doing around the loss and damage financial facility throughout the whole year. Overall, I do agree also that this COP27 again failed on delivering enough ambition and delivering enough concrete steps forward to address the climate crisis that we are facing today. And I think this is again is a missed opportunity. We do need these summits not only to confirm commitments, but actually to raise the bar higher and higher in terms of targets and in terms of financial engagement and commitment across the whole globe.
Sharon, I saw you nodding along. I want to give you an opportunity to add to the point she was making, if you'd like.
Yeah, because it's not just, you know, it's not just about that kind of just that funding, that kind of emergency response funding. It is about putting that investment there for futures and making that equitable and making that fair and accessible. And that's going to be a challenge to do it at the speed that we need to do. And in the meantime, you know, we've got biodiversity and free fall at the moment. We're losing species. We're losing climate change has a bigger impact than just economic. And at the moment, we're still investing around the world in fossil fuels. And this can't be right. You know, we're talking about billions of pounds in aid to help combat climate change that we're also spending, you know, money on combat. It's sort of working the other way with fossil fuels, and that we need to really take this serious at COP. And COP has a real leadership role to take us forward in this respect. And I think we're just not quite there, and we need that focus and that one voice globally if we're going to take this seriously.
Abdi, you know, we were speaking earlier about the fact that there's still a lot of decisions to be made, even when it comes to setting up this loss and damage fund. And it seems as though the negotiators, those that were present at COP27, have essentially kicked the can down the road and said that things will most likely be decided next year before COP28, at least some of the more difficult decisions. I want to ask you, what are some of the more difficult decisions? I'm asking that because clearly, it was very difficult even getting to this point. So what beyond this point is even more difficult that it couldn't be agreed to this year?
Well, a number of things. So first of all, the amount of money that needs to go into the fund needs to be determined. And where would it come from? I mean, we know that the 20 largest economies around the world are responsible for about roughly 80% of greenhouse gas emissions. And so, and we also know this is a very unique situation. China, which is currently probably the largest emitter of greenhouse gas emissions, is in fact considered and classified by the UN as a developing country, not as a developed country. And so when you are classified like that, but you are a large emitter of greenhouse gases, you know, how much are you going to contribute? Those are some of the details that need to be worked out. But also, you know, loss and damage also entails inherently liability. And some of the big countries like the U.S. are avoiding to be in a situation where they're trapped in some sort of a legal liability, perpetual legal liability for greenhouse gas emissions. So it is going to be quite complex before we arrive at a sensible fund. And even then, I think it'll be much less than what people have in mind today.
Kiara, Sharon was talking about what's really needed right now from her perspective is for the world to speak with one voice when it comes to action that really needs to be taken to combat climate change going forward. That being said, you know, COP27, there was a lot riding on that. And yet still you see that there were a lot of divisions among the participating nations. So have COP gatherings actually served much of a purpose over the years? I mean, have they been able to accomplish much since they started holding them decades ago?
No, I mean, I think that's not enough. That it's the answer. But we also need to highlight that and point out that we don't have an alternative. So what we have today is this space as the only space where all countries, poor and rich countries, big and big polluters and the ones most impacted by climate change can be around one table and take decisions to move forward. So I think not enough is my short answer, but at the same time, this is a space we should protect and we should strengthen actually to make sure that climate action is faster and really answering to the urgency we see. I think that the way we need to do that is to exactly what we were saying also in Sharm el Sheikh, to make sure that this space leads to decisions across the three main pillars of the Paris Agreement, adaptation, climate mitigation, and loss and damage, and not putting one or the other pillar in competition towards one another. Also, I think the most important thing to make these COPs in the future still relevant and impactful is to protect that space from the fossil fuels interests, meaning like ensuring that the space remain democratic, remain led led by governments and by delegates, and also ensuring that civil society has a voice in terms of making sure that the experience, the expertise, but also the struggles of communities on the ground are part of the conversation in order to influence the decisions that we want to see coming out of these COPs.
Sharon, how long have poorer countries and developing countries been seeking this kind of help from richer countries? And how big a win, you know, we can talk more about whether or not this money is actually put aside, but just the fact that they got to this point, how big a win is that for the poorer countries and for the developing countries that they even got this?
Well, in one sense, there's been a kind of admission that this needs to happen, an agreement. That's a massive achievement. But looking back, you know, in indirect ways, climate change has been starting to have an impact quite slowly. And but also not just climate change, actually the impact of energy exploitation and energy, the energy market has, you know, it has had an impact internationally on some nations more than others. And we've got complex issues around things like, you know, deforestation, loss of the Amazon, and massively complicated issues around our need for energy, coupled with economic complexity around a country's, you know, need to develop that income. So it's a complex picture. And in that mix as well, you've got people with different social positions within that those economies. So, you know, that's a very tricky question to answer. But I think what is needed, and I think one of the things that hasn't really been addressed in any of the COPs is anything like the accountability that we need. Like, where's the consequence if nothing happens? Then nothing happens, and there is no consequence for that economy that's kind of kicking the can down the road. So I think, you know, what would have been nice to see is more accountability and consequence for those nations that don't, you know, pull their collective weight to address this problem. I think that is, you know, that's something I think needs to be embedded in future COPs to really have those specific targets. Mm.
And Sharon, let me just ask, when it comes to the kind of pressure that activists and that NGOs were able to put on the participants in COP27, was that different this year than it has been in previous years?
I think so. I think there's a real sense of urgency. And you know, the in terms of the public voice and the voice of those organisations that are doing the campaigning, I think there's a real frustration that's coming through of the lack of urgency and the lack of action. And I don't think that's unfounded. I think that voice is going to become louder. And I think, you know, that's something we you know, if people are not feeling listened to, then they protest and they campaign. And I think that's something that we're going to see more of until, you know, things start to really change.
Kiara, I saw you reacting quite a bit to what Sharon was saying, so I wanted to see if you'd like to jump in.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the voice of civil society and activists was quite strong at this COP, even with the little presence that we had at the venue. But I think what is important to highlight is that it is a voice that is getting stronger and stronger across the globe. So it's not only in one country or another. So, and this, I think, would be extremely important to as a voice to be supported, especially in the run-up to the next COP, to make sure that also this decision on the loss and damage fund is quickly taken with all the steps that are needed to make that operational. And I also think that this is something we need to think through more as a civil society organization on how to link up all this pressure to the pressure that each and everyone is doing in his or own country. Because I think accountability, as Sharon said, is a key for the improvement of this process, but also monitoring decisions, and monitoring what are the steps that have been taken or the pledges that has been done. And allow me to mention as an example that many European countries put forward some financial pledges for loss and damage in the first week of the COP. I think that helped for sure to align around the decision on the loss and damage fund. But now we need to make sure that this financial commitment is additional and is well channeled through the right procedures and the right schemes to make that operational.
Abdi, one of the more unexpected things that happened while COP27 was going on was the announcement by the U.S. and China that they were going to resume cooperating when it came to trying to combat climate change and other issues. From your perspective, did that give more momentum to what was going on at COP27? Did that help some of these processes along?
There is no question about that. U.S. and China are the two largest economies, and by definition, they're also the two largest emitters of greenhouse gas emissions to this day. And so their cooperation is critical for the success of COP27 and this whole sort of environmental process. But Mohammed, I think we need to remind ourselves that the overarching objective of these international dialogues around environment is to reach the 1.5 degrees Celsius pre-industrial levels of, in terms of the greenhouse gas emissions. Now, the commitment to that objective remains incredibly weak, even after decades of negotiations. A lot of countries are willing to do it, but as my colleague said, the monitoring of aspects of it remains incredibly weak, and more importantly, a lot of Western countries are seeing the resurgence of far-right politicians who are actually also climate deniers. I mean, they don't even believe that we are sprinting into climate crisis, be it in the U.S. or Western Europe and so on and so forth. And I suspect that, unfortunately, that new reality will have an adverse impact on the negotiations in the coming years, especially if many more far-right politicians come to power in Western democracies.
Sharon, Abdi was just talking there about the goal of keeping global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Based on what you saw coming out of COP27, is that something that is still achievable? And also, there had been a recommitment that the globe needs to cut greenhouse gas emissions nearly in half by 2030. Do you think that is something that is still achievable?
I think it's really worrying that we're still seeing investment in fossil fuels with these massively ambitious targets. The amount that we have to cut CO2 by, I don't think, given current progress and climate change that's already hit now, I don't think it's achievable if we just carry on business as normal. Not even with the targets that we have, we're going to miss that target massively. So I think we need investment in technologies that are not just carbon zero, but carbon negative. You know, we need to be really proactive about that. And that's a huge step forward, over and above what's already been promised. So, just an acceleration in terms of the targets that we have is not enough. So, I think this brings together the power of reports like the IPCC, where, the scientific community come together and present the evidence that underpins those decisions. But I think we're beyond now thinking in terms of just economic terms. I think if we think about climate change just economically, and keep pushing the can down the road on economic decisions. And as you say, with these politicians mm-hmm. who are coming on board, who are not on board with the urgency and mm-hmm. the seriousness, it's easy to, in Europe, it's very easy to ignore these impacts when mm-hmm. We don't particularly see much flooding, or we don't see the extremes in the way that mm-hmm. other nations are seeing them. It's easy to deny, I think, but these impacts are going to hit us through things like mm-hmm. more difficulty in terms of our agriculture and costs and imports and exports, and also human migration is we're going to see a rise. And so, we're in very serious, right. A very serious situation.
All right. Well, we have run out of time, so we're going to have to leave the conversation there. Thanks so much to all of our guests, Chiara Martinelli, Abdi Ainte, and Sharon George. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. For me, Mohammed Jamjoum, and the whole team here in Doha, bye for now.